are starting to look at this pretty seriously, as well as agile modeling and agile data. So we'll be talking a fair bit about that today. I'm happy to say that I'm one of the Eclipse Process Framework committers. There's two. If you haven't heard about the Eclipse Process Framework, you'll probably start hearing more of it, more about it at least in the next few months. But the basic idea is there's two aspects to that project. The first one is the Eclipse Process Framework tool itself for editing and displaying process-oriented material. I'm not really involved with that. I'm involved with the content side of things, so I'm going to be open sourcing some agile methodology stuff. So I'm a firm believer in giving things away for free. So anyways, there's going to be some good stuff going on there. So we're going to start bringing bring this agile stuff into some organizations that want to see lots of process documentation. That way their developers have something that they won't read. So I'm a firm believer, I'm a firm believer in the concept, you ain't going to read it anyways. So if you're a Yagni person, you'll appreciate that. So one of the things I like to ask people is how many people here, if you take a look at these questions on these slides here, I think they're all pretty reasonable things, but how many people can say yes to all of these? Your time is spent wisely all the time, that your stakeholders will brag about how wonderful it is to work with you, and that your stakeholders will feel that you're spending their money wisely. Is there anybody out there that can actually say yes to these things? I'm semi-blind up here, so you could be like, everybody could have their hands up, I wouldn't know. Okay, one or two people sort of went like this. Okay, well, if you look at these questions, this is pretty reasonable stuff, right? There's nothing radical on this slide at all, yet few organizations can claim that this is true. So one of the things I would like you to think about over the next hour or so is whether or not some of these agile techniques I'm talking about can get you closer to this sort of, I hate to say that it's an ideal. This should be like the bare minimum when you think, yet unfortunately it's an ideal. This is an industry that's so messed up. It's phenomenal. I was sitting in some other talks earlier today, and the thing that, the common theme at this conference seems to be overcomplication of basic stuff. It's not rocket science. Developing software is not rocket science. And developing web apps, that should be a no-brainer. I'm shocked at what's going on in the Java community. And worse yet, I hate to say it, but we're getting our butts kicked by Microsoft in many ways. You need to go and take a look at Visual Studio, and they've easily caught up, if not surpassed, the Java world. So I'm sort of shocked, and it's interesting. I don't know how a developer would learn Java. I really don't. It's somebody new to the Java world. How the heck do you even find a tool set these days, let alone figure out how to build something? There's like 20 different, it's like Perl. There's like 20 different options to do everything now. It doesn't make any sense. So anyways, we got a few problems in this industry, so I went off topic already. I'm second or third slide, and I'm off topic. Okay, so anyways, what I want to talk about, the focus of this talk is actually on some agile practices, some of which you will have seen before, some of which may be new to you. And I'm going to ask some relatively embarrassing questions at some points. And that's okay, because we'll just blame it on senior management anyways. One of my philosophies is that if one person is messed up, it's probably their fault. But if a group or an organization is messed up, it's the manager's fault. So that last set of questions we saw tells me that we might want to start sending some blame up the food chain, I guess. So my presentation goals: I do want to challenge some of your beliefs on how software's development and how software's developed. This industry, I believe, is a total disaster. This concept of software engineering, questionable at best. It's interesting if you start looking at some of the history in this industry. The concept of software engineering came from the U.S. military. If you do a little bit of research, the U.S. Department of Defense is the worst organization in the world at developing software by far. The University of Middlesex in the U.K. for some reason loves to keep track of project failures and examine them, all that sort of stuff. And they've got a bunch of amazing stories to tell. But one of the things they do is they maintain a list of the most popular, the biggest IT disasters. Almost all of them can be attributed to the U.S. Department of Defense, the U.S. government, or the British Department of Defense. I can't quite remember what they're called, but it's the British DOD. So I question sometimes why we are listening, why we let this group of people who don't have any clue whatsoever define what we do as an industry. This concept of software engineering, bad idea. This concept of specialists, bad idea. This also came for the most part from some of this initial thinking in software engineering. And CMM and CMMI, it's coming from the Department of Defense. You know, why are we listening to them? I think we're reaping what we sowed in CMMI. The outsourcing industry is doing fairly well as a result. CMM, Capability Maturity Model Integrated. Lucky man. Stay that way, you'll be okay. Okay, so anyways, I'm a fairly blunt person, so don't be surprised if I offend you or offend your friends or your entire family or something, I don't know. But what I ask people, though, be open-minded, but be skeptical as well. And please don't make any career-ending moves. So, for example, I've got a very coherent story with significant research backing up that doing requirements up front, writing a requirement spec, is grotesquely incompetent. It's a huge source of wastage. It's a huge project risk. If you want to throw roughly two-thirds of your development budget away, do a requirements document. That's a very good way to work if you're interested in wasting money. And I'll show you the figures behind that. But at the same time, if your organization thinks that doing requirements documentation is a good idea, going back to your boss on Monday and saying, by the way, this is grotesquely incompetent. I'm not going to do this anymore. That might be a good way to get a job at another organization. So think about this. A lot of this, I'm going to talk about a wide range of techniques. You're not going to be able to do all of them tomorrow. You might be doing some of them today. I bet you some of them you haven't even heard of. And some of them might be completely and utterly incompatible with your organization. I'll also talk about a way to not throw all your money away and still manage requirements effectively. And it'll be interesting. My bet would be most of your organizations could not tolerate spending your money wisely. But we'll see when we get there. We'll do a show of hands. As far as my process background goes, I've done both sides of the fence. I've done the CMM, all the US DoD type stuff. I've done the Agile stuff and everything pretty well in between. So I'm a firm believer in using the right process for the job, and sometimes the CMM is the right sort of concept. It's just fairly rare that it does work out in practice, from what I've seen at least. And I've built very large systems, very small systems in multiple industries. I've worked on systems like literally process tens of millions of financial transactions a day, and I've seen some of these techniques work in that environment. I've developed life-critical systems where if we'd had a bug, we would have killed people. I've worked on systems where we had a bug, we wouldn't have killed people. So if you think that because you're working at a Fortune 500 company, you're special and some of this stuff isn't going to work for you, well, run the numbers. There's 499 other Fortune 500 companies. So you're in a fairly large crowd there. This stuff works in practice. It just might not be something that your organization can do. So that's a different story. So some of the things that I want you to keep in mind as well, this legacy stuff is here to stay. It's interesting that we all seem to be dealing with legacy technology and legacy systems, yet we never seem to talk about it. And I think we have this huge legacy debt that we need to start worrying about and digging our way out of. It's amazing how many organizations I go into where most of their IT budget is spent just desperately trying to keep these legacy systems up and running. And this is a losing scenario. If you don't have a coherent plan to deal with this legacy stuff that you've got, you are eventually going to go out of business. The legacy systems are not going to fix themselves. We've got to deal with this at some point. We need techniques, and I'll talk about them, like refactoring and database refactoring, that can slowly fix the mess. But we've got to do it. I'm not saying it's easy, and I'm not saying it's going to happen overnight, but you got to eventually do it. So keep this in mind. Individuals need to be flexible. I'm going to talk about a concept called generalizing specialist. And what a generalizing specialist is somebody with one or more specialties, Java programming, Oracle database administration, whatever it is that works for you. You got to have one or two of these specialties because you got to have some useful skills to share with the team. But you also need at least a general knowledge of software development. So you might not be an expert project manager, but you need to appreciate some of these things that project manager is doing. So that way you can interact with these people effectively. And you need to be able to step up and do that stuff sometimes if the project manager doesn't happen to be in the room at the time. And you should be open-minded and be willing to pick up these skills, because these are important skills to have. And better yet, you should have a general knowledge of the domain that you're working in. Okay, and it's interesting that if you start thinking about this, if you start asking yourself, what are some of the best people I've ever worked with? I bet you most of them would fall into this generalizing specialist category, or craftsperson, or Renaissance developer. We've got multiple terms for this concept, but you know, we need to start thinking about this. So, and call it like it is. The wider range of skills you've got, the greater the chance that you'll have interesting work and find employment sometime in the future. So it's good for you, and it's good for your organization. The larger the organization, the greater the range of techniques you're going to need. A very common mistake that organizations make is to try to have one process. You know, every team is going to follow the exact same process. That makes it really easy to mismanage your IT effort, but it pretty well kills your IT projects, because we know that a team of three people working on a two-month project is probably going to work in a slightly different manner than a team of 30 people working on a three-year project. It's not rocket science. They are not going to follow the same process. So let's stop doing this fantasy stuff, and let's start, you know, mixing and matching techniques. So one of the things you're going to hopefully get out of this is this concept that there is this wide range of techniques, and I'm going to have to do the right thing at the right time. And as an IT professional, you want to put as many of these techniques in your intellectual toolkit as possible. So what's this agile software development stuff all about? It's interesting. It's basically, I think the best way to describe it is it's a highly collaborative approach to development that's evolutionary in nature, iterative and incremental. So this evolutionary stuff is probably not new to you, but there's a slight hitch. It is highly collaborative. We're working together. It doesn't have to be co-located in a single room. That's a spectacularly good idea, though. But you know, you can still be agile and be spread out all over the place. Just I would advise against that. But more importantly, we deliver working software that meets the changing needs of our stakeholders. Change is a good thing. A change requirement late in the life cycle is a competitive advantage, as long as you can act on it. So if you're working in an organization where you have this change management process in place, where your goal is to prevent scope creep or feature creep, you fundamentally don't get it. That is not what your stakeholders want from you. The stakeholders pay your salary. So you're following. So you know, management's idea of a good way to work is to do something that the people paying the bills don't like. That doesn't seem to be a winning strategy to me. That's not a change management process. That's a change prevention process. Call it like it is. Okay, so the Agile values, I'm not going to go into details here. If you haven't come up to speed on the Agile values by now, drop by the Agile Alliance site, I guess. The important thing about this slide, which a lot of people seem to thrash on, is that all of this stuff is important. It's just the stuff on the left is way more important than the stuff on the right. And it's interesting, like for all this talk about individuals and interactions, the Agile community has done a heck of a lot of work in the open source community over the last few years building some really good tools. So, you know, frankly, if you're to list some of the better tools out there and some of the more popular ones, like, you know, say JUnit perhaps, it's coming from the Agile community. So keep that in mind. So all the stuff's important, but stuff on the left, a little more important than the stuff on the right. And it's interesting. I would argue that the traditional community has got this set of values backwards, which is probably why they struggle. The Agile principles. There's a little more to the manifesto than just the four value definitions, and this is something that often gets missed. We are very quality oriented. One of the biggest challenges I think in this industry right now is that it's very difficult to tell when a team is agile or not, because there's a lot of people out there saying, "Oh yeah, I don't write documentation, therefore I'm agile." No, you're a low end hacker. Get out of my way. Okay, so I look for two fundamental things from an Agile team when I go in to evaluate them. First, I want to see your test suite. I want to see it run, and I want to see the code. And there better be roughly about the same amount of testing code as there is real code. Okay, unless you got some legacy issues and you just haven't got caught up yet, so you know, got to play fair, right? But I want to see those tests run. The second thing I want is I want to be introduced to your stakeholder, your customer, right now. I don't want to hear an excuse, oh, well, he's at a conference or he's down the hall or, you know, we get to talk to him once a month if we're really lucky and have to bump into him in the cafeteria. That's not agile. Most agile teams, like 99.9% of them, have direct access to the stakeholders at least on a daily basis. Might not be for the entire day, but it should be a good couple hours. I should be able to get information from them and get them to make decisions really quickly. If not, I'm probably not agile. I'm probably fooling myself, even though I'm not writing documentation. And you know what? Agilists write documentation. It's just that we're very smart about it. One of the things in the agile community, we treat our stakeholders with respect. They were smart enough to earn the money. They're also smart enough to spend it. So we don't have these traditional processes that you know, say, oh, well, we're going to go out and we're going to create an architecture document. That's arrogant. That assumes the stakeholders aren't smart enough to make that decision of whether or not they want to invest their hard-earned money in your architecture document. In the agile world, if we think an architecture document is a good idea, we go to hat in hand with our stakeholders and say, hey, we think we should invest in this. Here's why. Here's what it's going to cost. Here's the benefits. Would you like to spend your money on that? And if the answer is no, well, okay, fine. We won't do that then. We'll go off and build working software instead. And it's interesting, once you start putting a price tag on all these things that we do, people start cutting this stuff out pretty quickly. They start minimizing the foolishness. And this is threatening. I'll show you how we can do that in a bit. Another very important concept in the Agile community is one of communication. This concept is from Alistair Coburn. And what he's done is over the years, he's gone into organizations and he's basically asked the question, how can you be successful at software development? And he's noticed, he's come to the conclusion that communication and collaboration are critical things. And so what he's done is he's put this graph, one of the many things that he's done, is he's put this graph together that compares the effectiveness of communication techniques. So what you want to do is, depending on your situation, strive to use the most effective communication techniques possible. So if you're co-located in a room, it's stupid to send somebody an email. You're far better to get up, talk with them, and better yet, talk around a whiteboard and do some sketching and, you know, talk about whatever it is you need to talk about. And another interesting thing about, but, you know, if you're not co-located, if, you know, you're working with people on the other side of the country, okay, then maybe a video conversation is the way to go. And maybe email is the way to go. And maybe you fly people back and forth every so often to build up the team. I was actually in an organization earlier this week where one team was in on the East Coast, the other team was in Europe. And they flew, and they were doing Scrum. And what would happen is the Americans would fly every second month to Belgium, or every second month the Europeans would fly to the States. And for 1 week, they'd be co-located. And then for the other 3 weeks, they'd be phone calling and stuff, emailing and stuff like that. But they knew how important it was to make sure communication was effective on this team. Interestingly, handing documents back and forth is the worst way to work. So the preferred traditional way of working in practice appears to be one of the worst ways to work. So keep that in mind. A very common process smell is if you're handing artifacts off from one group to another group or from one specialist to another specialist, you're probably in trouble. You're injecting defects. And worse yet, you're probably not very effective. You're probably doing far more work than you need to do. So if you've got a team that's built for, you know, it's made up of a use case modeling specialist, a Java coder, a UML modeling specialist, a database specialist, and a testing specialist, what's going to happen? All those specialists are going to do great jobs. Okay, let's just assume that they're very good at what they do. They're all going to do great jobs, whether or not you need them to do great jobs. If you've got a use case modeling specialist on your team, that person is going to create great use cases, whether you need them or not. And that is the fundamental problem. That database person, they're going to do a great database job. And that Java person is going to do a great Java job. And you know what? The work they do is probably going to overlap because they're both dealing with structure. They're both dealing with business rules. They're both dealing with reference integrity, stuff like that. A lot of extra work is going to happen there. And you know what? They're both going to do a great different job. And we've all seen that happen when you go try to map your, map your object schema to your data schema, suddenly you got some horrendous data performance problems, and now you're arguing over which way to do things. Bad idea. But that's the traditional way of working, I guess. Okay, so let's get into some of these common Agile practices. Like I was saying, some of them you'll have seen before. Some of them are definitely part of XP. Some of them you will have not seen before, or maybe you've heard about them but didn't try to do them. All of these things are good ideas, whether or not you can tolerate it or not. Regular deployment of working software. It's software development. The only accurate measure of software development is the delivery of working software. Everything else is a lie. So if you've got your managers running around talking about earned value, so the idea with earned value is you've got a plan in place and you have different milestones in the project plan. We're almost always based on delivery of artifact and reviewing the models and reviewing the documents and stuff like that. That is not earned value. That has nothing to do with software development. That's justified bureaucracy. It's a wonderful marketing scam. I really admire the bureaucrats out there for getting away with this. What a wonderful term for justifying their pathetic and miserable existence. The only accurate metric is the delivery of working software. And if you are not delivering working software on a regular basis, that team is in trouble. That's a wonderful metric, too. Oh, look, no software. A software development team not delivering software. Management should clue into the fact there's probably a serious problem on that team because they're not getting anything done. Pair programming. How many people here are working in an environment where you're pair programming? Okay. How many people have tried it and given it up? Are there any hands up? I'm like blind here. Why did you give it up?
I personally don't like pairing. I'm into preview review. It's like work with someone, make sure you communicate, and make sure that someone is checking your work. But I don't think it has to be a real-time pair.
So did you give pair programming a try, though? Try it for a few weeks or a month?
Yeah.
Okay, it didn't work out for you.
Actually, we have a policy in place where we do pairing.
When it's really tough? Okay, so it's interesting. So it's a way to reduce. You're using it as a way to reduce risk. So mistakes are okay early, but when it counts.
The assumption is that risk late towards the deliverable less of something than earlier on.
Okay, interesting way to work. Apparently, the code you write early isn't as valuable as the code you're writing towards the end. I don't know why. Might be a process smell. Not quite sure on that one. Anyways, good luck. Okay, pair programming is a fairly good idea. And what I suggest, and it sounds strange, we're going to have half productivity, the world's going to come to an end. What a load of crap. I'm sorry, right? Okay, so run the numbers on this. You're coders. Chances are pretty good you've got 30, 40 years of programming in you. I know that doesn't, now you're depressed and you all commit suicide. But anyways, you got 30 or 40 years of coding in you. Say it's 40 years. What's the impact of, say, having a team decide for a month that you're going to pair program, everyone on the team is going to pair program for a month, and we're going to figure out whether or not pair programming seems to make sense for us. That's like 1 month out of, 40 times 12, whatever that is, a big 480? It's trivial. Don't worry about it. Try it. See what happens. See what happens. I was in at a large bank, all the banks in Canada are large, but I was in at a large bank last summer, and they're trying to make the decision to go agile, right? So this bank had roughly 200 projects were either underway or about to start sometime that year. So they're thinking about going agile. And so I turned to them and said, well, you got 200 projects. Why don't you do a pilot or two, right? It's like a 1% or 2% risk. Well, we couldn't possibly do that. What happens if they fail? And I said, well, how often do your projects fail around here? Oh, they never fail. So you know they're lying to you, right? So it took about 5 minutes and got out to them. Roughly half of their, they had a 50% failure rate in this company, which is about normal. And I said, okay, so you got a 50-50 chance of failing anyways, and it's like only a 1% or 2% risk. Who cares? This is a no-brainer. Considering the possible impact, you should at least be experimenting, right? So it being a large bank, they're not exactly the swiftest people in the world. So I suspect it'll be like 2007, 2008 before they start trying these things. But at least they're thinking about it now. So think about some of these things is what I'm saying. And question the banks. I'm saying that too. Okay, active stakeholder participation. This is actually an extension to the on-site customer concept in XP. So in XP, an on-site customer or a stakeholder is there to provide information and to make decisions in a timely manner. I don't want to have to wait for information. I don't want to have to wait to do analysis, right? That's just dumb. If I need the information, I need it now. Give me a good guess, and if it's wrong, okay, fine. Tell me when you get, you know, when you get a better answer. In agile, this concept's actually from agile modeling. In agile modeling, we take it one step further, and we say, well, you know what? We got a live body in the room. Put them to work. Because the business people, the stakeholders, the experts, well, you know, they're the ones that know about the requirements, right? They're the ones that understand the domain. So they're probably the best people suited to do that sort of modeling, right? Why have a technical person do requirements modeling? When, you know, the technical people are great at technical things. They're not that good at the business things. Business people, they're sort of good at business things, not that good at technical things. So let's use the expertise where they're good at. So then the onus is on us to find ways to allow, to enable our stakeholders to model. So we need simple tools. We need simple techniques. Every business person I've ever met has the ability to use paper, has the ability to use a whiteboard. Most business people I've met can't spell UML, let alone do it. Can't do data modeling. They might sort of understand it, but, you know, it's bubbles connected by lines. But you know what? They can draw on a whiteboard. It's interesting. When you're on your planes going home or, you know, you're browsing the magazine rack, you know, sometime this weekend, flip open a few business magazines or even a few technical magazines and take a look at how many business ads there are with people standing around whiteboards or people giving presentations with whiteboards in the back with all this really cool stuff on them. The number one modeling tool out there right now today is a whiteboard. How many people here do whiteboard sketches when they're doing software development? All the time, yeah. How many people here have a book with whiteboard sketches in it for models that I didn't write? Isn't that a shame? The book writers, the authors, the so-called experts are not writing about what they do in the real world. They're writing about this fantasy software engineering concept that doesn't seem to work. How many people here have, I'll ask two questions. First of all, how many people here work in an organization where the company has gone out and bought some sort of case tool like Rose or TogetherCC or whatever? Some sort of cool. How many people here, keep your hand up if you're actually using them in practice. A fair number of hands went down, okay? So roughly, what, a third or so of the hands went up and, you know, lost a few of them when asked if you're using them. Not quite as common. Nowhere near as many people doing whiteboarding or paper modeling or whatever you want to call that. Simple tools and techniques seem to work. Although there's nothing wrong with case tools if you're using the case tool in the proper manner. Modeling with others. This is the modeling equivalent of pair programming. The general idea, which we still haven't sort of found a way to communicate well, I guess, is that you should never work alone. Software development is a lot like swimming. Very dangerous to do it alone. That's when errors get injected. That's when people go off in a fantasy land and start doing their own thing. That's when you start seeing people write code that only they understand because they're the ultimate genius. How many people here have ever seen that happen? How many people here have not been screwed in that situation? Oh, well, I wrote really good code. Yeah, okay, I don't want to hear about that. Okay, yes, it's a known risk. If you've got somebody who only knows that part of the system, who only understands the data model, who only understands that module, you've got a serious problem. And the way you deal with that is you never allow somebody to get into the position where they're the only ones that know that piece of the system or that aspect of your project. There's no call for that. It's always a bad job. How many times do we have to get burned like this? So don't allow people to work by themselves. Grandpa was right. Two heads are better than one. Refactoring. How many people here are doing refactoring when they're coding? Okay, how many people here were doing it 5 years ago? A few, okay, yeah. Some of you are probably doing it, not realizing, but that's okay. Okay, so anyways, so we know that a code refactoring is a simple change to the design that doesn't change the semantics. It's interesting, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, none of the IDEs really supported this. Okay, so it was pretty tough to do something simple like renaming a method, like renaming an operation. Because, you know, you'd rename it and blow up in your face and
It'd be bad in the, you know, the global search and replace stuff never seemed to work because you'd rename a few things you didn't mean to rename, and you know, it's just always bad news. So anyways, but now the IDs are fairly smart, at least for the, some of the simpler refactorings. They're all automated. It's a no-brainer, just the way it should be. We can still do the same thing with databases. How many people here can refactor their database successfully? Okay. Actually, here's a better question. If I was to ask you to go back to work on Monday morning and rename a column in your production database and successfully roll that into production, how many people could, without breaking 100 apps, how many people could do that? Lower your hand if you're working in like a small company with one or two apps. Yeah, well, one or two hands went down. Okay. Lower your hand if you got if your access to your database is encapsulated fully because you're using Hibernate or something. Okay. Yeah. Okay, it's interesting. How many people here work in an organization where you can't do that? Where you couldn't, there would be no way on earth your data folks could possibly do that. A lot of hands are going up. Isn't that a shame? Your data group can't do the trivial things. They're not competent enough to do something trivial. Should be a warning signal. That's another process smell, right? It should be trivial to do trivial things. And I'm going to show, and you know what? My claim is that they could, in fact, do that if they chose to get off their lazy asses. And I'm going to show you how to do it tomorrow in my talk tomorrow afternoon. And better yet, buy my book and I'll give you the source code for it. Well, I'll sell you the source code for it. Because you know what? It is trivial to do, and it should be trivial to do, even in an environment where you got 100 apps hitting that database, and all 100 apps are written in a different language. Now, I'm not sure if that's even possible, but as we all know, in many organizations, you got some Java, you got some VB, you got some COBOL, you got some Fortran, you got some of this, some of that. And you should still be able to roll that safely into production in less than a day. Don't know why you want to rename a column in less than a day, but you should be able to do it. Because fundamentally, if you can't do the simple things, you're not going to be able to do the hard things, right? And that means your database is an anchor around your neck. How many people here work in an organization where you've got a perfect, the data quality is perfect in the database? You've got like the ultimately perfect database. Okay, so in every organization, there's some room for improvement, right? And that's normal. Don't be ashamed of that. It's totally normal. How many people work in a company where there's a game plan to evolve your database schema to get it good? A coherent game plan that works. I should, put a few adjectives in there. Okay. Isn't that a shame? Your data group has given up. Not only can't they do the basic trivial things, they've given up, which is probably, there's probably a correlation there, too. Okay. Think about this. We need to start raising the bar. So I'll show you how to do that tomorrow. Sandboxes. The basic idea here is you've got to be able to safely work in your own environment. Now, this is not new to the Agile world, without a doubt, but it's amazing how many times I get into organizations where the developers don't have a copy of the database, or at least don't have access to their own their own space within some sort of shared environment. That's nuts. Totally nuts. Because as a developer, I've got to be able to play. I got to be able to make some changes, see what happens, and if they work out, then I share them with the rest of the team. If they don't work out, either I fix it or I back out of it, right? But if I've got to worry about blowing somebody out of the water whenever I do something, what's going to happen? I'm not going to do anything, right? It's too damn risky. Or I'll have to hold meetings and design reviews, and we'll have all these sessions and try to come to a consensus and follow some process, and then suddenly we're wondering why we got outsourced to India. There's probably some sort of correlation there, too. So the basic idea is that the developers can work in their own environment. Once they get good at it, put it up to your project environment. There should be some sort of pre-production demo environment, QA. Better yet, I'm a firm believer in doing integration testing as soon as possible, doing acceptance testing all through the life cycle. Don't leave acceptance testing to the end. This is another one of the great lies in the traditional community. When you do acceptance testing at the end of the project, that is in no way, shape, or form acceptance testing. Because think of the situation. You've burned through several $1 million, you're late, you're over budget, and now you're going to your stakeholders and saying, thanks for the cash, can you please do some acceptance testing on this and sign off when you're comfortable? Come on. They can't stop the project. Who is going to stop a project where you've burned through several million dollars already? Nobody. That's ram it down your throat testing. That's we pretend to listen to your opinion testing. It is not acceptance testing. If you want to do acceptance testing, you got to do it often and you got to do it early, or you got to give it a more accurate name, because this traditional stuff is not acceptance testing. If you even have time to do it. And I'm sure many of you have seen how the testing effort gets cut towards the end of a project. Test first design, or test first development, maybe. This is not really a testing technique, but the idea here, how many people are here doing TDD? Okay, a few. Okay, the idea is that you write a single test, and then you write enough production code to fulfill that test, and you slowly build your system up over time. If you work like this, there's a couple of huge advantages. First of all, your system works. That's always good. You've got tests to show that your system works. You're always in a position to say, hey, everything I've built so far to date actually works, and I can prove it to you. Assuming, of course, you've got testing skills and all sorts of stuff. So there's a slight hitch in that plant. So you got to have skilled people. But what a beautiful situation to be in. I love to be in this situation. It's very hard to, if you get a team that's truly agile, they will clean the clock of the traditional folks. There's no possible way you can compete against that. It doesn't get any better. And it's interesting, if you take a look at some of the things the traditional folks talk about, like the cost of change curve. And what they've, the cost of change curve is exponential. Now, one of the great lies, I guess, in the agile community is that the cost of change curve is flat. Interesting rhetoric, but it's not accurate. The agile cost of change curve is exponential. An exponential cost of change curve is one of the fundamental laws of physics in the software world. But from the agile point of view, it appears flat. And the reason why is because all the techniques we do, like test-driven development, like refactoring, like modeling with others, like pair programming, reduce the feedback cycle. So pair programming reduces the feedback cycle down to the order of seconds. That's a very good point. Yeah, so if you write the test first, you're effectively doing design at that point. You're doing detailed design. So one of the side of... Okay, the question is, the point was that by writing the production code, the business code, and then writing the test, you design the test to reflect the code. Okay? Although, to be fair, you can write the test first and always return true, right? You can fake anything. But if you're doing it honestly, a huge side benefit of writing the test before the production code is that it forces you to think through the design of the production code. So what happens is, in the agile world, we do a lot less design modeling, detailed design modeling, because we don't need to. We're actually doing design. We do a heck of a lot of design. It's just that we're doing it with tests rather than diagrams. And this is one of the things that really freaks some of the traditionalists out. They don't see how a lot of the stuff that they do fits into the agile world. And the answer is, a lot of the stuff they do does not fit into the agile world because it's not that good of an idea. So we've been rethinking a lot of things, and then these side effects start kicking in nicely. It was interesting. In XP, they had a lot of problems describing to people why they don't need to do this modeling. They still do modeling, by the way. It's just that they don't have a modeling phase. They don't do all these useless modeling, big, huge models up front. So they're still doing the activity of design. They still do a heck of a lot of analysis, a heck of a lot of requirements gathering. It's just that they're not doing much in the way of documentation unless somebody's willing to pay for it. So it's different, is I guess what I'm saying here. So continuing on. So test-driven design is the combination of test-first design plus refactoring. So the basic idea is that whenever an agilist has a new feature to implement, the first question they ask is the existing design the easiest design possible that allows me to add this new requirement? If so, they add it. If not, they refactor it, then they add the requirement. And then doing the test first stuff, all that good sort of thing. The side effect of this is that at all points in time, agilists have very high quality code. So we end up with a high quality system, and that works, that fully implements the requirements that we've gotten to date. So you've got working high-quality software. Fairly decent position to be in. And it's at all points in time on the project. If we can only figure out how to spend money wisely, we'd be good to go. I'll show you that in a couple minutes. We do continuous regression testing. We're constantly testing our code. The longer you go without testing it, the greater at risk you are. So we're constantly trying to test. We can also do database regression testing. So if you've already downloaded these slides, this is one of two new slides that I added on the plane on the way here today. So not only can you test your code, you can test your database. How many people here work in an organization where you got a full regression test suite for your database? I should be able to go into your organization right now, press a button, run a script, and it's going to run through a suite of tests that show that your database is very good. Okay? How many people here work in an organization where your data management folks shoot their mouths off constantly about data quality? Well, hands are going up now, right? They talk about it. They don't actually do anything about it. It's easy to talk about quality. Not so easy to ensure it. And how many people here work in an organization where you got a data management team that is talking about doing database regression testing on a continuous basis? Because it's not rocket science. Yeah, okay. Oh, good question. Okay, so what this slide is getting at, there's a couple interesting things here. First thing, unfortunately it's a Microsoft thing, so maybe it's bad, but the dotted lines represent threat boundaries. Microsoft has gotten reasonably sophisticated when it comes to security, which I know sounds strange, but being everybody's favorite target, they've gotten pretty good at figuring the security stuff out. So the idea is that when you're testing a database, this is actually something called single sourcing information. Put information in the best place. Hopefully, record it once. So one of the challenges in the Agile community is the XP guys are challenged sometimes when it comes to communicating what they do. So they'll tell you, oh, yeah, the design is in the code. Most of the design is in the code because most of it's in your tests. But you know what? We still do overview documents, assuming that somebody's willing to pay for it. Because overview information is best captured in, like, you know, high-level diagrams sometimes. It's not good to try to capture them in tests. It doesn't seem to work out too well. Detailed design information, capturing them in unit tests makes a heck of a lot of sense. Use the right tool for the job, right? Continuous integration, we're constantly building. You know, if you got to run the you got to write the test, write the code, then you got to build the software, test it, right? So we're constantly doing continuous integration. Now, actually, the Maven guys are out on the show floor, so I'm probably preaching to the choir on this one. Or, you know, Ant, good thing too. The XP guys decided to make it a full-fledged practice, one of 12. That's, you know, at 9% of the process, or 8%, you know, if you're counting somehow. In Agile, so in XP, they've got the coding standards practice. In Agile modeling, modeling standards. There are modeling standards. You know, there are well-known ways that you can lay out a diagram and make it easy to read, easy to understand. It's interesting, and usually it's not what the case tool vendors are advising you to do, but, you know, details, right? Okay, so this is some of that promised research I was showing you, or talking about earlier, about the big requirements documents. So BRUF stands for Big Requirements Up Front. So the idea, what this study shows, this is from the Chaos Report, from the Standish Group, and you know, there's a few challenges with the way these guys collect data, but like from an academic research point of view. But you know what? It's the best information we've got because the academic community hasn't done, you know, an academically pure study, I guess you'd say. So anyways, we've got to take what we can get. So you can actually get the raw data, I guess, if you want to pony up the $5,000 for the, and the project team delivered software. They might have been late, they might have been over budget, but at least they could sort of somehow, you know, politically, they could declare a success at some point, right? What the Chaos guys did, they went back, and so of the hundreds of projects where this was the case, they went back to the stakeholders and asked the question, so of the stuff that got delivered, what do you actually use? On average, and this is across hundreds of projects, big, small, different environments, all that sort of stuff, 45% of the functionality was never used. An additional 19% was rarely used. That's almost two-thirds wastage. And that's success. Two-thirds wastage, and we declare that success. Could you imagine being the CIO in your company and having to explain, if the CEO ever got a hold of those figures, how you could possibly explain why you've got two-thirds wastage? The stakeholders are in complete and utter control of the scope of what they get. They're in complete and utter control of the budget. And they're in complete and utter control of the schedule because they can fund that project for as long as they want, to the extent that they want. If it's a multi-team environment, so if the stakeholders have a choice of software development teams, they can start investing in the teams that provide good value for the money and start reducing the budget for the teams that don't provide good value. Investment 101, they can spend their money wisely. What a wonderful environment. So interesting, in the traditional way of working, how many people here work in organizations where you do some sort of fixed price thing, where you've got a fixed budget at the beginning of the project and all sorts of stuff, right? How many people here work in an environment where the stakeholders manage their money and give it out to a bit at a time and make sure you're spending it wisely? A few people. How many people here work in an organization where you'd be able to do that if management understood that they had an option now? Who could add it? Who aren't doing it now but could probably talk management into it? Okay, that's not so bad. A few of you. How many people would there be no way you could possibly do this? What a shame. Your organizations can't tolerate spending their money wisely. Work for the government? Bank? Insurance company? Yeah. It's interesting. A couple of years ago, question.
In this slide, you're talking about requirements. Are you pitching that as stories written by customers that don't have any awareness of how one piece of technology depends on another piece?
Yes. Could be stories, use cases, features, shall statements, whatever works for you. Doesn't matter.
But the prioritization here is entirely done by the business unit.
Yes. Now, everybody's, oh, well, what happens if you've got some architecturally significant piece of crap that hits the bottom, right? Well, you know what? You might never hit it because it's low priority, so who cares? The other thing is if you're developing high-quality software with a full regression test suite in place, and, you get high-quality software, so it's loosely coupled, highly cohesive, what are the chances are of you hitting an actual real-world requirement that's going to blow you out of the water? Not much, right? So don't worry. And you know what? If that's possible, well, I'll show you a way around that anyways, but if that's possible, you probably would have gotten blown out of the water anyways with a traditional approach. So it's interesting. What we've been finding in actually doing this in practice is that we do end up with software that's easy to maintain. We do end up with software that supports change easily. Now, every so often, we go down a rabbit hole, right? Because you go off in one direction and you go, ooh, that was bad. And you don't find that out for a couple months, and then you got a major refactoring in your hands. So I'll take any questions later because I'm starting to run out of time. So what you want to do is take a modeling approach. So in Agile model-driven development, and this is something the XP guys do. They're not very good at discussing it. But during cycle zero, the first week or two of the project, you do some initial modeling, right? Because this initial stack of requirements have got to come from somewhere. They don't just get beamed down from the Starship Enterprise, right? You got to do some brainstorming. Somebody's got to tell you, let's start working on this. So we do some initial requirements modeling at a very high level, but still enough to get a handle on the scope. We also do some initial architecture modeling. Get together in a whiteboard and say, oh, yeah, I've got a browser, and it's going to talk to this, and that's going to talk to that, and talk to that, and, we'll be using JMS here, and, BEA there, and Oracle there, and all that sort of stuff, right? We're going to sort of figure out how we think we're going to build it. We're not going to document the heck out of it. We're not going to build it all at once. We're definitely not going to build a framework or anything like that around it. But at least we're going to have a game plan. We're going to say, this is how we think it's going to work out. And hopefully you're like 90% right, and then you'll find out that BEA doesn't talk to Oracle, or that does. But maybe you'll find out that it doesn't. You never know, right? So anyways, so we're smart about it. And the XP guys do this. This is nothing new. They're just not good at talking about it. Then what happens during the development cycles, during the things that the XP guys like to talk about, you do just-in-time modeling. You do what's called model storming. And so the idea is that you pull a requirement off the stack and says, okay, build a screen that captures customer information. That's not a lot of information. Okay, a customer information screen. Tell me more, right? So you do just-in-time analysis. You talk to your stakeholder. You get, you know, you, together you draw a screen sketch on the whiteboard, and you start talking about basic layout and basic data validation stuff. You get to the point, yeah, I think I can build that. And you go off and you code for several hours or several days. Then you come back to them and say, okay, you told me to build this. This is what I built. What do you think? They go, oh, well, it should be here and here, and oh, you missed this. Oh, I forgot to tell you about that, and oh, it should be blue instead of green and all that sort of stuff, right? So you iterate back and forth. So what happens is now your feedback cycle is down to hours or days, not weeks or months that you see in the traditional world. So Agile is still model. They still document. It's just that they're pretty smart about it. And it's interesting that when you start doing it, so we're still doing the requirements modeling. We still do the design, you know, the design effort, often in the form of tests. So we're still doing all this work. It's just that we don't have all these extra work products coming out of it, like, you know, documents that nobody ever reads other than the reviewers. How many people here have ever been on a project where you had like a fairly well-documented architecture and you still failed? Right? Or the developers ignored it and did something else. Right? Clearly a wasted effort. There is no correlation whatsoever between documentation and project success at all. So we might want to stop these things. And there seems to be a fair bit of evidence that this documentation stuff is not helping us at all. Well, it's helping the professional reviewers and the documentation experts, I suppose, but it's not really helping us get software developed. So the point of this slide is that there's many different ways to model, not just this case tool stuff, not just this MDA foolishness. How many people here work in an organization where you got a lot of UML experts kicking around, you've got a really good UML tool that you've bought into, and you're successfully developing software with it? Anybody? Okay, how many people here work in an organization where somebody's running around talking about MDA? Yeah, a few people, right? This MDA stuff doesn't make a lot of sense other than for a very small minority of people, which is okay. It still works, but not for everybody. So you can sketch. You can talk. You can do this case tool stuff. Nothing wrong with that. Just use a decent case tool. So don't have your modeling choices narrowed by the developers who are trying to sell you very expensive tools. What this slide is getting at is, many Agile projects, they'll do inclusive modeling, whiteboarding, paper type stuff, and then, you know, somebody goes and they code at the machine, right? This, I believe, is about, you know, they're still modeling, it's just they're using simple tools. Is you're still doing some whiteboarding stuff to think through some of the bigger issues where it's still flexible, work with your stakeholders, all that sort of stuff, and then you use the tool to do visual modeling. So you draw your class diagrams and your sequence diagrams and your data, you know, your data models and all that sort of stuff, and you generate the code and you reverse engineer the code and you go back and forth. This might be 15-20% of all project teams. Great way to work, and it works very well when you got the tools and the people that can use the tools. But if you've got a couple of people on the project that are not visual thinkers, that's not going to work out too well for you. I ran into a company a few months ago. They were like one of the poster childs for MDA. And they were successful with it. Don't get me wrong. But as soon as the project ended, all the developers on it realized, hey, I'm an MDA expert now. I've been written up. I can go consult. They all left. The project, in my mind, was a complete and utter failure as a result because now they have this unmaintainable system because they don't have anybody on staff that can use the modeling tool. But at least they've got a platform-independent model, and that's what counts. So, because some bureaucrat can review it. Yes. Good thinking, guys. Or then there's the Agile MDA approach, where you still do the inclusive modeling because you've got to interact with your stakeholders somehow. Then you do the platform-independent model and the platform-specific model, and then you develop working software, and you do transformations back and forth. And that does work. This gentleman over here, assuming he's not lying to us, it's working for him. And it does work for some people. But it requires, you know, really sophisticated modelers with a great set of modeling tools, and you've got to be willing to totally marry that tool vendor because the tools don't integrate with each other. XMI is a complete and utter lie. Always has been, always will be. There is not a single combination of two tools or three tools or four tools. You can put as many in a row as you want where you can work in one, interact with people, this modeling stuff, understanding requirements, interacting with your stakeholders, critical to your success. So be flexible.